ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Middle East ceasefire deal in doubt as Israel continues to bomb Lebanon. Also, the Prime Minister in Singapore on a mission to shore up Australia's fuel supplies, and public buses in Darwin to be patrolled by safety officers with guns.
This is absolutely a new low for the Northern Territory because we're simply going to be allowing people to have guns in the community to create further fear and division.
The ceasefire agreement in the Middle East is looking tenuous this evening after Israeli strikes on Lebanon killed hundreds of civilians. Iranian officials and Pakistani negotiators insist that the Israeli attacks on Lebanon were supposed to stop under the agreement, but Israel and the United States are denying that. Negotiations for a permanent peace deal are due to start in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad tomorrow. Rachel Hayter reports.
In the space of 10 minutes on a single spring afternoon, the Israeli military launched 100 strikes on Lebanon without notice, including on densely populated residential neighbourhoods. 51-year-old Beirut resident Naim Chebo survived, but his home was struck in the bombardment.
We are living in a nightmare. This is my place. This is my house. Everything destroyed. See? Look. I will pray and then sleep. That's it.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described the strikes as the biggest blow to Hezbollah since the Pagers attack of September 2024. The Lebanese Health Ministry is reporting at least 180 people have been killed. Emergency Service, the Lebanese Civil Defence, put the death toll at more than 250.
This is absolutely shocking and stunning and absolutely unacceptable.
Lebanon's Social Affairs Minister, Hanin Sayed, warns the attacks will make the mass displacement of people in Lebanon worse.
We're going to have more displacement. These hits now at the heart of Beirut.
About 20% of the Lebanese population have already been forced from their homes. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports at least 1.3 million people are now displaced. The Iran-backed militia Hezbollah describes the Israeli strikes on Lebanon as a ceasefire violation and has retaliated, firing rockets at the small kibbutz of Manara in northern Israel. Iranian officials and Hezbollah legislator Ibrahim al-Musawi insist the ceasefire included Lebanon.
The truth of the matter regarding the agreement, if we look at the drafts of this agreement, whether in Farsi or in English, or even in what was announced by the sponsor of the agreement, who is the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Lebanon is included.
But Israel and its ambassador to Australia, Hilal Newman, dispute that.
We're fully supportive of the ceasefire and we will continue to support the ceasefire. But at the same time, there must be an understanding of the threat of the Hezbollah from Lebanon.
US Vice President J.D. Vance also denies that Lebanon was included in the ceasefire. He's leading the American negotiators at peace talks planned for the Pakistani capital, Islamabad.
I think the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't. We never made that promise. We never indicated that was going to be the case. What we said is that the ceasefire would be focused on Iran, and the ceasefire would be focused on America's allies, both Israel and the Gulf Arab states. Now, that said, the Israelis, as I understand it, again, I'm supposed to get a fuller report when I get on the plane, have actually offered to check themselves a little bit in Lebanon because they want to make sure that our negotiation is successful.
The Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says Lebanon should be included in the ceasefire. Charlotte Gretsch-Maden is a research fellow and lecturer at the Australian National University who studies ceasefires. She suggests they're more likely to fail when key belligerents like Hezbollah are excluded.
There is a genuine concern that if Hezbollah is involved, it may slow down the talks, the peace process, as time and energy is spent on trying to incorporate their views into the process. By contrast, however, not including Hezbollah relies on the power of the main conflict parties to contain them and reduce support for them, if that is the wish. And so overall, the prevailing view is that Hezbollah and spoilers should be included.
Despite the Israeli strikes on Lebanon, an Iranian delegation is heading to Islamabad to meet with US negotiators in the coming days.
Rachel Hayter reporting. The ABC's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem. Matthew, what are the chances this ceasefire is going to hold so negotiations on a permanent end to the conflict can start tomorrow in Pakistan?
Well, Sam, I think that is the big question everyone is asking at the moment, because it goes to this point around the confusion that is out there as to what is or is not part of this ceasefire deal. So clearly, Iran, in agreeing to this deal, it believed that Lebanon was going to be part of the equation here. And that is why we have seen very strongly worded statements coming from Iran condemning this action by Israel. But for Israel and the United States, they are saying that Lebanon was never going to be part of it. And that is why this ongoing military action is happening there. So it really is the big question here as to whether or not it can last the distance. And Iran promising to react here to punish Israel for these strikes, weighing up its options, that could blow this whole situation wide open.
Are you clear, Matt, on how that confusion about Lebanon arose? I mean, don't they have to write it down somewhere?
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? I mean, the statements that were coming out from the Pakistani Prime Minister, and Pakistan, of course, instrumental in brokering this deal in the first place, that was very explicit in saying that Lebanon was going to be part of this deal. It's not necessarily surprising to many commentators that Benjamin Netanyahu has taken a different path here. And certainly it did take a couple of hours for the White House to effectively lock in behind him. There is some conjecture that the White House has done so because the situation has developed in such a way that it can't now say, well, hang on, no, Lebanon was part of this, without it becoming quite an embarrassing situation for all involved. But what we need to remember is that, you know, if that was indeed the case, if the US was under the impression that Lebanon was part of this, then there has been already a serious straying from what was agreed to just a couple of days ago. And we do need to stress that there is a lot of confusion going around here. So there are varying versions of the agreement that Iran has been putting out there, this 10-point plan. Donald Trump's White House, his press secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, saying last night, local time, that one of the versions going out there is totally wrong and should be put in the bin, and that is not what they agreed to.
Well, speaking of confusion, what's the latest on the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz?
So, again, confusion seems to be the word of the day here. That was clearly going to be part of this agreement, that Iran would have to reopen the Strait of Hormuz without any restrictions there. And that includes things, according to the White House, that includes things such as not charging tolls or anything like that. Now, even if that movement was underway yesterday, once this series of intense strikes, 100 strikes in the course of 10 minutes across Lebanon happened, Iranian state media started to report that the Strait of Hormuz was not going to reopen in protest of that. Again, the White House is saying that that doesn't tally with their intelligence on the ground. That is going to be the real another one of these real sticking points in this period where these negotiations are underway, if indeed we get to that period of negotiations, whether or not the Strait of Hormuz, the restrictions there are eased enough to satisfy Donald Trump.
The ABC's Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran speaking to me from Jerusalem. It's a difficult time for Australia's Lebanese community. Melbourne lawyer Emily Soraya was two when her parents fled the Lebanese civil war in the 1970s and migrated to Australia. She keeps in touch with people in Lebanon daily. She told me when she heard the news yesterday that a ceasefire agreement had been reached between the US, Israel and Iran, she assumed the attacks on Lebanon would stop, and she was shocked to hear that Israel had ramped up its strikes on Lebanon late last night, Australian time.
I felt very helpless, and it really affected me psychologically because I do have a lot of friends in Lebanon, close friends and family as well. We were appalled. We were very, very saddened. You know, we tend to forget sometimes that there are a lot of innocent people that are caught up in these civilians, and they don't deserve this. People just want to live in peace and harmony. Everyone's had enough.
Have you managed to speak to anyone who was actually near the strikes in Lebanon last night?
I have had contact with people today who are not far from where it was, and they've all just mentioned their fear and they're devastated.
What did they think, Emily? Did they think the ceasefire meant the strikes on Lebanon would stop?
Well, they did, because their understanding of the meeting that was held in regards to the ceasefire, the international, where, you know, people just came up with a conclusion, well, yeah, the ceasefire is going to be a solution at the moment. Many people thought that it included Lebanon.
What can you tell us about the areas that Israel struck last night? Are they areas where Hezbollah personnel are known to be based?
Well, a lot of these people that got caught up in this, that were killed, are innocent civilians that don't understand politics, and they just go on in their daily life of living and just surviving.
And they don't know anything about Hezbollah living in the areas they're living in?
Many people don't understand what politics in the region, what the complex issues and certain groups, they don't understand much about them.
Emily, we're hearing 1.3 million people in Lebanon now have been displaced because of the conflict. How are Lebanese Australians working to send help?
Well, many of these Lebanese citizens rely on family members or friends outside their country, and I can speak for myself, having family in Lebanon and friends, I have a duty to help, whether it's via assisting with food distribution, clothing, shelter. The organisation I'm part of, the Melbourne Lebanese Ladies Charitable Group, is a non-profit organisation where they help the needy.
Emily, you moved to Australia when you were two. Your parents were fleeing the civil war in Lebanon. All these decades later, how do you reflect on your parents' situation 50 plus years ago and what's happening in Lebanon now?
It hurts me to see Lebanon going through these struggles and have been for many, many years, and it's not coming to an end. We're witnessing images of the young and the old and the needy that are affected. And this just gives me some kind of flashback of what my family have been through and the struggles. And, you know, they fled and left everything behind just for the sake of having peace. God bless Lebanon and its citizens. And thank you so much.
Lawyer Emily Soraya is a committee member of the Melbourne Lebanese Ladies Charitable Group. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, will soon start talks with his Singaporean counterpart to shore up Australia's fuel supplies. Before flying out today, he announced the government would underwrite fuel deals with two energy companies, the aim being to bring more fuel into a market struggling to keep up with demand. Angus Randall has more.
As the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, heads to Singapore to ensure the fuel keeps coming in, he's announced another deal closer to home.
This is additional supply here in Australia that they will be able to source. And as part of this agreement, of course, the government can direct where that supply goes.
Speaking at Ampol's Brisbane oil refinery, he says the government's export agency, Export Finance Australia, has made a deal with the nation's two biggest fuel importers, Ampol and Viva Energy, underwriting purchases that might seem too risky.
There is supply available on the spot market. We know that that's the case. This will enable Ampol and Viva to participate in that market.
Most of Australia's fuel comes in through long-term contracts, but there's another market that allows buyers to purchase fuel in the moment. Energy Minister Chris Bowen goes into further detail.
These cargoes become available at short notice and quick decisions have to be made, and this agreement will now enable those decisions to be made.
By underwriting these spot market deals, the government agrees to pay the difference if an importer buys an expensive shipment right before the price falls. In return, the government has a say on where in Australia that fuel will go. Chris Bowen hopes it will encourage these companies to engage in the more volatile spot market.
With the oil price moving around, with a lot of speculation about what will happen in the Middle East, these purchases become even riskier for companies like Ampol and Viva. The oil price might move substantially. So this arrangement will enable the companies to take a purchase that would have been non-commercial and to go out and buy that fuel for Australians that otherwise would go to other countries. And that is very much in our national interest.
Kevin Morrison is an energy analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He says the government believes it's worth the taxpayer investment to ensure that Australia can keep the fuel coming in.
If we don't have get secure the fuel supplies, then it has a wider economic effect on, say, the mining sector, the agricultural sector, the freight sector. That's why the government wants to get involved, because just of that wider economic impact.
Anthony Albanese will speak with Singapore's Prime Minister Lawrence Wong tomorrow. His biggest job is to ensure that Singapore keeps sending fuel, even as it considers its own domestic needs. John Berry is the geopolitics lead at KPMG. He says the Prime Minister is reaping the benefits of decades of strong relations with Singapore.
This kind of trip of being able to meet with senior government officials in Singapore to talk about how to tackle these fuel challenges collaboratively, that doesn't happen unless you've got years and even decades of investment in good relationships and positive trade relationships and economic integration.
Back home, the number of petrol stations without diesel has continued to fall, down to 216 nationwide today, mostly in New South Wales. The federal opposition is calling for a fuel dashboard showing data on fuel stocks and ships coming in.
Angus Randall. The Northern Territory government is being slammed by the NT opposition for putting armed officers on public buses. They're called police public safety officers, but they don't have the same training as regular police. The government argues they're needed to tackle violence and antisocial behaviour on the territory's public transport system. But opponents of the plan are worried having gun-carrying officers on buses could lead to the deaths of more Indigenous people in custody. Jane Barden filed this report.
Major brawls, drivers being attacked, and fights between drunk passengers are regular on Darwin's buses. Often groups of remote Indigenous residents sleeping rough in city park drinking camps get onto public transport very drunk and aggressive. Riding the bus is a scary experience for many passengers, including Darwin local Liz Matty.
For me, it's not safety, because usually people sometimes they go drunk and then they're fighting.
Right. What do we want? Yeah. What do we want?
Last year, bus drivers protested outside the parliament and went on strike, demanding more security measures. The government made bus fares free to try to reduce conflict and closed down Darwin's main bus interchange, a scene of many big fights. The Transport Workers Union NT organiser Barry Norton says it hasn't been enough to stop the violence.
We welcome any attempt to address this situation, because in the Northern Territories it is the worst in the country.
In June, the NT government will introduce a new unit of armed police public safety officers to start patrolling buses. NT Treasurer Bill Yan.
Police public safety officers, whether it be on our streets or on our bus network, we know that physical and visual presence has an effect on antisocial behaviour. That's effectively a given.
The new public safety officers will replace police auxiliaries and government transit and public housing security staff. They'll have fewer investigation powers than police constables and receive just 4 months of training rather than the 7 months that constables get. That's worrying Darwin bus passengers like Heath Baxter and Roger McHugh.
Having the transit officers having guns is a bit extreme.
What's guns for? Pepper spray is good enough, but not guns.
NT Labour Opposition Deputy Leader and Arundaman Chauncey Paik has condemned the move.
This is absolutely a new low for the Northern Territory to create further fear and division rather than addressing the real issues.
Other states have armed officers in public transport hubs, including protective services officers in Victoria. Chauncey Pegg thinks this will be a more risky policy in the NT.
More guns won't make our community safer, and this decision will absolutely result in the potential of further fatalities across the Northern Territory.
Most of the deaths in custody or while trying to take people into custody in the Territory have been Indigenous people. Are you worried that particularly Indigenous people might be most at risk?
People are really anxious and frightened about these new measures. This is absolutely 100% out of the Trump playbook. We know that the best way to reduce crime is to deal with the real root causes: housing, education, health, and real pathways for social and economic inclusion.
The NT government and NT police responded with a statement saying that public safety officers are receiving the same training for defensive tactics and firearms as constables get, and the officers will prevent antisocial behaviour and minimise harm associated with alcohol misuse, which will provide community confidence and a safer territory.
The report from Jane Barden and Roxanne Fitzgerald in the NT. Residents of central Victoria who endured the biggest bushfire in Australia this year are complaining of severe delays in the state government's clean-up program. The Longwood fire burned through more than 140,000 hectares of land 3 months ago. As locals and volunteers try and rebuild, one local MP is accusing the Victorian government of unfairly prioritising some residents over others. Kathleen O'Connor has more.
After the summer bushfires in January, the small town of Ruffey in central Victoria was almost unrecognisable. It's now April and the recovery process is dragging on.
At the moment we've still got a lot of trees on the side of the road that haven't been cleared, a lot of trees across people's boundaries. They still haven't been able to fix up their boundary fences on the road.
Chris Backer is the captain of the Crichtons Creek CFA Brigade in northern Victoria. He helped tackle the fire.
A lot of the signs and everything still haven't been replaced on the side of the road, still burnt or missing. So it hasn't really progressed too much.
Both the Victorian and federal governments invested more than $120 million in the clean-up program, but some residents claim they're still not getting the support they need from the state government. Bill and Judith Eddy have lived in Ruffey for more than 80 years. They lost some shearing sheds and fences in the fire.
Well, we just want the sheds and that cleaned up. I mean, it's not only us, it's lots of houses in the district that haven't had any help either getting cleaned up.
They're underinsured and say that according to the state government's criteria, they should be eligible for the assistance program.
We registered with the ERV, Emergency Relief Victoria, back in 31st of January, and they come yesterday to assess it, and now we've got to wait another 10 days till they assess it, and then we'll have to wait to see if we got it or not, and see if they approved. A lot of people had other cleanups done, and it's cost them a lot of money. And we need support after this fire, we really do. It's getting us down.
The local MP is Nationals' Annabelle Cleland. She's calling the state government's assistance program the most inequitable cleanup program the country has ever seen.
For the first time in a decade, we've got a two-tiered cleanup program where insured families are totally missing out, and those who are uninsured are receiving extensive support from the government to clean up.
Ms. Cleland says most residents were sick of waiting and have cleaned up their properties themselves, and the state government should have introduced a universal system where all properties impacted by the fires are eligible for support, regardless of whether or not they were insured.
It should not work like that in Australia.
George Noy is the CFA captain of the Ruffey Brigade.
The residents have been coming down to the hub and talking to the services available to get the sites cleaned up, so it's a massive process.
He says the current fuel crisis has also slowed down the recovery process, but there's been an overwhelming response from volunteers wanting to lend a helping hand.
The hay runners, church groups, just far and wide, it's been overwhelming, the support. It's going to take years to get back on track, but you know, we've had some rain, so the grass is growing, so there's positive light around.
The state government says an extra $15 million has been passed down to local councils to help fund support workers to help those in the community navigate their way through the assistance programs.
Kathleen O'Connor. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on ABC Listen. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. He was threatening to wipe out a whole civilization. Then, about an hour before his deadline, Donald Trump announced a ceasefire deal had been struck with Iran. They'll now spend the next 2 weeks negotiating a peace plan, but so far it seems like there's little they can agree on. Today, an international affairs expert on what comes next. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.